from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A group of Yemeni women staged a protest in the capital Sana'a to slam Saudi atrocities. They called on the international community to charge Riyadh with war crimes. Press TV's Mohammed Al-Attah filed this report from the Yemeni capital of Sana'a.
Saudi Arabia continues its relentless air bombardment of Yemen in defiance of the international calls for a halt in the attacks during the holy month of Ramadan. A group of Yemeni women have staged a rally in front of the Attorney General building in the Yemeni capital Sana'a to call for the prosecution of what they describe as agents of Saudi monarchy.
This rally calls on the Attorney General to prosecute those who encouraged Saudi Arabia and its allies to invade Yemen and kill their own brothers.
Demonstrators carried banners and chanted anti-Saudi slogans, saying that they will not back down before what they describe as the U.S. proxy war waged by Riyadh against their country.
To the United States, Saudi Arabia, and the allied states who participated and supported this aggressive war on Yemeni people, we are not afraid of your plans and your missiles, even if you kill us to the last Yemeni.
Among the female demonstrators, there are displaced women from different parts of the country, including Saada province in the north, a province that human rights activists say has witnessed one of the worst wars in the world's history.
Despite the vicious and indiscriminate war waged against us in Saada and also the hardships we encountered during our displacement, such genocidal war will not deter us from marching toward our set goals of independence and prosperity.
There is growing anger among the people here who say that Riyadh will regret its unlawful war on Yemen and that the victories by the army are just the tip of the iceberg. Mohammed Al-Attab, Press TV, Sana'a.
The war in Yemen was also the subject of a discussion at the UN Security Council Wednesday. The UN's special envoy on Yemen, Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed, spoke with the press after making a presentation at the council session. He detailed the desperate situation facing the people of Yemen and said a ceasefire for the delivery of emergency aid was the top priority. However, he refused to name the parties responsible for blocking aid thus far.
Who's responsible for not accepting a truce, at least to allow the humanitarian aid to go to Aden in particular and the rest of Yemen?
We have over 21 million Yemenis today in need of humanitarian assistance. And if you compare that, I was humanitarian coordinator during my time. It was 7 million only 2 years ago. Now we are 21 million. 20 million Yemenis cannot have access to safe drinking water. Over 1 million are displaced from their homes, etc. And we can go on. I think today, for me, it's an imperative for all the parties, and for me, everybody is responsible until we find a possibility of having a truce ceasefire. We prefer that this truce is linked to a political process, the one we have outlined, because then it's much easier to monitor. Because in the past, the truce we had for the pause we had for 5 days was violated, but it was not possible for us to prove the violation because we did not have a mechanism of monitoring.
However, American journalist Caleb Maupin was able to monitor the denial of aid to Aden as an eyewitness last month. He spoke with us via telephone Wednesday.
I was on an Iranian ship, the Iran Shahid, chartered by the Red Crescent Society, and we attempted to bring aid to the port of Hodeidah in Yemen. And I know full well who it was who prevented us from delivering the humanitarian aid to Yemen, and it was the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, who bombed the port 8 times in a single day, and in addition to that, had Sudanese mercenaries positioned around the port. The Saudis are doing everything they can to prevent aid from getting to the people in need. They're preventing people in Yemen from getting assistance as they bomb and destroy the country with their cache of U.S.-made weapons. The Saudis are violating international law, and the people of Yemen are resisting them and resisting their campaign of aggression, and they have every right to do so. The people of Yemen need humanitarian aid. And the attempts to block humanitarian aid by the Saudis are absolutely unacceptable and really just a crime against humanity.
Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said Greece's international creditors rejected another new proposal, which would have granted added concessions in pensions and other areas. He made the statement prior to the opening of yet another round of negotiations that was set for Wednesday. RT's Lizzie Phelan filed this report from Athens early Wednesday.
That's right. The Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has said that some of the international creditors have not accepted those Greek proposals that were put forward in an attempt to try to reach a deal before Greece runs out of cash to pay its IMF debt next week. Now, he broke the news on his Twitter saying that these creditors have never before been so persistent in rejecting equivalent measures, neither in Ireland nor in Portugal. And he said that their stance shows that they either don't want to reach an agreement or that they are serving some specific interest. Now, he didn't elaborate on what those interests are, but on Monday, he put forward those proposed measures, which included raised taxes for companies and people on middle incomes and high incomes, as well as raised contributions to healthcare from pensioners. And they were initially welcomed as a step forward by some EU and financial leaders, despite them saying that there was still some work to do. However, this doesn't mean that the talks have broken down, even though this is a very surprising U-turn, and the hope that seemed so vivid on Monday that a deal would be reached seems to have faded. But the Prime Minister Tsipras has flown into Brussels to attend those emergency talks that will go ahead as planned. And as we speak, the discussions are ongoing, but time is running out before that June 30th deadline for Greece to pay its 1.6 billion euro debt to the IMF. But here on the streets of Greece, people are extremely fed up with this ongoing uncertainty. We've seen 3 days in a row of protests and growing divisions between supporters and opponents of the Greek government. We spoke to some members of the public, and here's what they had to say.
The agreement of the Greek government with bankers of abroad is something that bites a terrible our budget.
I'm marching here against austerity. They've drunk our blood. They've taken our pensions, and we don't know what to do.
I trust my government, the actual government, but I don't trust our European partners because it seems that they don't have a clear position.
On the streets here in Athens, I'm Lizzie Phelan for RT.
And we'll have an update tomorrow on the talks that were still ongoing at press time. In Paris, the foreign ministers from the so-called Normandy 4 group, Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany, met to discuss the status of the Minsk ceasefire deal for Ukraine. RT's Peter Oliver reports.
The main conclusion made was that the Minsk agreement must be adhered to. We heard from Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, saying that all of the foreign ministers that were gathered here in Paris for this latest Normandy 4 meeting had all been in agreement that Minsk was the only way forward for a political and a peaceful solution. He also said that when it came to the contact group, the next meeting of the contact group, they would be discussing the establishment of a demilitarized zone around the town of Shirokina. He also said that there needed to be more dialogue, there needed to be real dialogue between Kiev and the self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk. But in terms of the breaches of the ceasefire, Sergei Lavrov didn't go as far as to name names, but did say that there were entities out there that wanted to try and push a military solution to the conflict.
During today's meeting, we all realize the dangers of actions taken by certain forces who want to use a military solution.
So when it came to the ongoing conflict in the east of Ukraine, all of the foreign ministers in unison saying that Minsk was the only way forward and that the ceasefire agreed in Belarus must be adhered to. So that's basically all coming out of here in Paris after that meeting of the four foreign ministers, the foreign ministers of Russia, Ukraine, France and Germany.
Yeah. Fighting in Ukraine has taken the lives of several thousand Ukrainians. there have been violations of the Minsk agreement by the government and, the government claims, by rebels in the east for the past several months. The French government's been embarrassed after revelations that three of its most recent presidents, including the incumbent president François Hollande, have been spied upon by the United States. The French government summoned the U.S. ambassador after leaked documents showed Washington spied on Hollande and his two predecessors, Jacques Chirac and Nicolas Sarkozy. Hollande's office issued a statement saying Paris will not tolerate any acts that threaten its security. That statement came after Hollande held an emergency meeting with the country's top security officials to respond to the revelation. French officials also said U.S. authorities had made commitments in 2013 that they would not spy on France's leadership. A spokesperson for the French government said Washington spying on its allies is unacceptable. Following the revelations, Hollande reportedly spoke by telephone with U.S. President Barack Obama, as RT's Guyan Chichikayan reports.
Well, obviously, there's no transcript of what exactly they said to each other, but judging by the readout of the conversation that the French put out, President Obama said he agrees that it's a bad idea to spy on an old friend. In fact, he's been saying that since 2013. Coincidentally, that is the time when Edward Snowden's revelations surfaced, and those showed that the French were spied on a massive scale. An NSA graph showed an average of 3 million data intercepts a day. On this latest batch of NSA reports published by WikiLeaks, the White House said this: we are not targeting and will not target the communications of President Hollande. Past tense is missing. So presumably the French got a commitment from the White House that they will not do it again. But the French press did not take the allegations lightly. Le Monde writes, the U.S. does not have allies. Le Parisien goes, the U.S. wiretapped Chirac, Sarkozy and Hollande. The Elysee Palace fell prey to big American ears. L'Express says, anger at the top of the French state, target of large American ears. So when the scandal hit the headlines, the French government had to show some indignation. President Hollande summoned the Defense Council over this. Then they summoned the U.S. ambassador to France for a meeting. But then in the same readout of President Hollande's phone conversation with President Obama, we read the French intelligence officials will travel soon to Washington to, quote, deepen cooperation. So maybe the French government is not so angry after all.
Hollande's political opponents lashed out at his tepid response to the reports. Aymeric Chauprade is a national security consultant to the National Front Party's head, Marine Le Pen. He said he believes that a majority of French citizens want a restructuring of relations with Washington.
We have to rebuild completely our foreign policy, and we have a proof now. We have everything to, we need to do that now, but unfortunately we cannot expect nothing from this non-independent French government, because there is nothing to expect from an ally which is not a true ally. I think it's exactly the same case as what happened in Germany. I think that there is a majority in France, a majority of citizens, a lot of people that think that we should stop to develop such a relationship of submission with the United States. We have to stop that, and there is probably a majority to do that.
But the scandal has even outraged members of Hollande's own party. Roland Dumasis is a French lawyer who served as foreign minister under socialist President François Mitterrand from 1984 to 1986 and 1988 to 1993.
I'm not surprised for that. I'm shocked, awfully shocked, by the behavior of the American authority, but I'm not surprised. Since I said several times ago that we are in the wrong way with the relation of Russia, and we must be different way to talk with the Russian friends and to be more careful with the American.
When asked what response was needed by the average French citizen, Dumasis said it must be a very strong one, invoking the decision by former French President Charles de Gaulle, who pulled this country's military command out of NATO in 1968.
It would be necessary to have a very strong reaction, very strong one, like the General de Gaulle decided to do it after the years of 50s and 60s. It was very difficult relation with America. We're in the same situation today. But we are not with General de Gaulle. He is dead since a long time.
The U.S. military has apparently issued new guidelines allowing it to kill journalists. The Department of Defense's Law of War Manual, which sets forth the explicit rules of engagement for the Pentagon, appears to allow journalists to be defined and targeted as enemy combatants. RT's Anya Parampil spoke with Chris Chambers, professor of journalism at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., about what the new rules could mean for journalists in the field.
So this manual is pretty massive. It's over 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to read it all, but I looked into how they define journalists, and I want to read it to you. They say, in general, journalists are civilians. However, journalists may be members of the armed forces, persons authorized to accompany the armed forces, or unprivileged belligerents. What does that mean to you?
I don't know what it means, because the Geneva Convention, other tenets of international law, even United States, you know, law on this, and federal courts have spoken on this, doesn't have this thing called unprivileged belligerence. I mean, you're either an embedded reporter, you're a reporter for Stars and Stripes with the Army, so you're a member of the armed forces, or you're not. You're either a civilian or you're a soldier. But even if you're a soldier, you still have protections under the Geneva Convention. You can't be tortured. You can't be deprived of food, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't understand where this is coming from or what empirical data they are basing this on.
Right, or what the implications are. I mean, I guess I interpret it as very specific language, right? They say persons authorized to accompany the forces, as you said, that would be embedded journalists.
Right.
So doesn't this already just favor embedded journalists over independent journalists who may be in war zones?
There are two troubling things about this. First, it gives them license to attack or even murder journalists that they don't particularly like but aren't really on the other side. So it might be somebody from RT or Al Jazeera or whomever, a French station, a German station, a Chinese station that they don't like there. And it can also mean people who are just there observing kind of as neutrals. You know, I mean, it would basically excuse the murder of those journalists that, you know, that made WikiLeaks famous.
I was just going to bring that up. I think we have the video of the collateral murder video that WikiLeaks famously released. But you can see the two journalists right there. They worked for Reuters, and they were completely targeted in that strike. And we know, I guess, Obama's definition of an enemy combatant is anyone of military age, a man of military age, right? So then,
who happens to be there?
Right. So now this guideline just seems to be a version of that, even if they are carrying a camera.
Yeah, the Geneva Convention's pretty clear on this. And then even before 1977, when there was a change defining journalists as civilians, period, end of story. Even then, journalists were given some kind of protection. I mean, they had to be providing like material help to the enemy. They had to be like toting weapons, carrying, or maybe de facto spies, basically, is what people are talking about. There's an exception for spies in the in military law and international law, but they're not talking about that. They're talking about journalists, you know, making a new category to put journalists in where they have no proof that this has even occurred.
Right, and they're trying to, I guess, in one article I read in the Washington Times, make it about people sending people who aren't journalists into a zone as a spy. But it doesn't, need for a free press kind of outweigh, does that even happen?
I don't know. I mean, again, they need to explain, are there like people who are bloggers that are entering a war zone on behalf of ISIS or something? We just don't know. And again, this could be used against foreign press and their stringers who were just there, as in Baghdad. You know, and Reuters people, you know, they were Reuters employees and their stringers there take, you know, as journalists.
Right.
That they just don't want in the way, so they kill them.
It's really disturbing language, I guess, but the Pentagon did not respond to our producer's request to define what unprivileged belligerents
mean. I'm sure their legal
department
is going over it, and is the National Press Club and the Society of Professional Journalists, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Journalism professor at Georgetown University, Chris Chambers, thank you.
Thank you.
As the U.S. Congress prepares to hand President Obama fast-track authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, treaty, Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford analyzes the political context for the treaty.
In the weeks before Barack Obama began his first term in office, we at Black Agenda Report described him as a center-right politician, based on the cast of characters he chose for his cabinet and his announcement that Social Security and all entitlement programs would be put on the chopping block under his presidency. 6.5 years later, Obama stands at the far right wing of his own Democratic Party, and on issues of corporate domination to the right of many Republicans. Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, the 21st Century Blueprint for Global Corporate Rule, garnered only 28 Democratic votes in a showdown on Capitol Hill last week. But, backed by 190 Republicans and all the assets that Wall Street can muster, Obama delivered a crushing defeat to his own party and to the health and welfare of all humanity. So rotten is the stench of TPP, a treaty so toxic that it's a state secret, that only 3 members of the Congressional Black Caucus were willing to side with the first black president. The black TPP 3 are Gregory Meeks, the corporate servant from Queens, New York, Terry Sewell, the sellout who misrepresents Alabama's black belt, and Eddie Bernice Johnson, the congresswoman from Texas who occupies a special place of shame since she also voted in favor of the disastrous NAFTA jobs-killing treaty 22 years ago. Back in 1993, Obama's political mentor, Bill Clinton, crossed over the aisle to lead Republicans to victory over his fellow Democrats in the fight to pass NAFTA, the treaty with Canada and Mexico. Clinton got a much larger share of Democrats to go along with his jobs-killing bill, but most of the party still opposed the deal. 102 Democrats voted yes versus 156 that said no to NAFTA. 6 members of the Congressional Black Caucus went along with Bill Clinton: Carrie Meek of Florida, Mel Reynolds from Chicago, who 2 years later was forced to resign after a conviction for statutory rape, William Dollar Bill Jefferson, the money man from New Orleans who hid cash in his refrigerator, Floyd Flake, whose New York seat is now held by the thoroughly corrupted Gregory Meeks, Harold Ford, who went on to become George Bush's favorite black congressman, and Eddie Bernice Johnson, the only one of the 6 still in a position to betray more than 700,000 of her constituents in Dallas, Texas. In the generation since passage of NAFTA, the black economy has collapsed, largely due to the flight of manufacturing jobs to low-wage foreign shores. On Barack Obama's watch, black wealth fell to 1/20th of median white household wealth, making it statistically impossible for African Americans to ever hope to reach parity with whites, short of a revolution. TPP will hasten the pace of social and economic decline in the United States, the real legacy of Barack Hussein Obama. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
As the situation in the Dominican Republic for Haitians and other dark-skinned people reaches a critical point, Black Agenda Radio's Nellie Bailey brings this report on the situation in the Dominican Republic.
The deadline passed last week for Haitian migrant workers in the Dominican Republic to register with the government or face deportation. The cutoff date for people of Haitian descent who were born in the Dominican Republic passed back in February. Together, the two groups number far more than 500,000 people. Daoud Andre has some background on the humanitarian crisis.
It's more than a year since this process was started, and out of the hundreds of thousands of undocumented Haitians working in the Dominican Republic, living in the Dominican Republic, the process that the government set up over there was so difficult. It was set up so that people wouldn't be able to get through it. A grand total of 300 people were able to obtain documents. The government over there is saying that close to 200,000 people were able to start the registration process. First, they had said that they would not accept any more documents, that they would take a 45-day period to evaluate the documents that they got. And as of August 2015, they would start what they call mass deportations. Now, this is what they say. In fact, what's happened is since the 90s, you've had consistent deportations, sometimes more than others. And this year, 2015, so far for 2015, we understand we've seen numbers from 8,000 up to 40,000 Haitians who have already been deported to Haiti. And despite promises that the Dominican government made that they would not deport people with a registration ticket. This is like people who started the process. But in yesterday's New York Times, there is an article about a woman who was deported, was rounded up in a sweep on Monday, despite having her registration ticket, and deported to Haiti. This woman is in Haiti as we speak. So what's going on in the Dominican Republic, we've spoken about it before, it has to do with racism. Non-Haitian undocumented immigrants in the Dominican Republic, of which there are Chinese, there are Germans, there are Spaniards, these people, they're not worried. If the complexion of your skin does not look like an African, like a black Haitian, you have no need to worry, because the police will never stop you to ask you for documentation. But if you are black and you are from, I don't know, the United States, and you happen not to have your passport with you, you're at risk of being deported to Haiti.
So we're talking about two groups of people. One, Haitians who actually were born in Haiti and would be classified as migrant workers. And exactly. Then folks who live in the Dominican Republic who are of Haitian descent, who may have
who
never
are born
seen
there, but of Haitian descent. Yes. Like I said, the deadline to apply, they had categorized Group A people who had some kind of document at birth, and Group B is people who never had a document. And you have to understand that it's always been the decision, you know, of the hospital worker, the state employee at the local municipality, when a parent would go to register their child, you know, they would look at the child or they would look at the parent and say, you know, we're not giving you a birth certificate for this child. So those people, they would fall into Group B, people who are claiming birth in the DR, but never had a document, and people who, by the grace, I should say, of God, you know, or a state employee got a birth document, they are Group A. The deadline for these people were in February, but both groups are subject to deportation to Haiti as of today, supposedly if they don't have a registration ticket for having started the process. The 300 is from the group of immigrants, undocumented immigrants. This is neither A nor B. These are not people who have claimed birth in the DR. But also in the group A and B, you have less than 8% of the people who applied who have gotten documents as well. And we're talking also hundreds of thousands of people. So the whole process, it was a joke.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.